Welcome. For those of you who haven't heard this about 5,000 times, I'm Tim Murray, Director of the Society for the Humanities. And I'd like to welcome you to the... I'd like to welcome you to the plenary talk of this weekend's conference on Global Aesthetics, Intersecting Culture, Theory Practice, sponsored by the Society for the Humanities and the Central New York, the Mellon Central New York Humanities Corridor, with significant assistance of the Humanist Foundation, for which we're tremendously grateful. Yeah, in considering potential conference plenary speakers for this very interesting and challenging weekend that we have, who might put the problematic of global aesthetics into critical and theoretical relief, I didn't have to look much further than down the hall to our Cornell faculty fellow at the Society for the Humanities, Bruno Bostils. Our fellows have come to join... now this doesn't make any sense. Our fellows have come to join me in my appreciation of Bruno's witty and acute insight, which always seems to bring his readings to the core of the matter in both critical and reparative fashion. This insight comes, moreover, from a wealth of erudition that permits the mobile scholar to move fluidly, but tremendously accurately, between the terrains of European and Latin American literature, philosophy, aesthetics, and art. Bruno's passion for Alain Badiou is matched by a zeal for Latin American artists, such as the Argentinian painter Guillermo Cuitca, on whom Bruno has written extensively, who has a major show actually up in New York right now at Sperone Westwater Gallery. His research interests include the crossovers between art, literature, theory, and cartography. He was one of the, motivators and movers behind the new cartography movement, as well as the radical movements of the 1960s and 70s, decadence, dandyism, and anarchy at the turn between the 19th and 20th century, which is his Society for the Humanities project. He's also works tremendously hard on articulating the communist hypothesis, cultural studies, and critical theory, as well as the reception, which is tremendously important, of Marx and Freud in Latin America, about which he's taught us so much. Indeed, Bruno has been relentless in encouraging the theoretical community to take a closer look at the tradition of Latin American dialectical thinking and its practical as well as thoughtful consequences on contemporary theory. Personally, Bruno also has taught me to rethink the delights of mixing barbecue with Coca-Cola, which lends one more inclined to admire his skills at laying hardwood floor and flagstone. He's a thinker who strikes quick at the hip while layering his critique with humor and friendship. So now for the official introduction. Bruno Bostils is professor of Romance Studies at Cornell University and the general editor of Diacritics, which is a renowned critical theory journal published out of Cornell's Department of Romance Studies. Before coming to Cornell, he held positions as an assistant professor at Harvard University and Columbia. He's the author of, now I'm going to really get into trouble because I'm going to try to pronounce all of Bruno's titles, which will show me for what I am. He's the author of Badiou o el recomienzo del materialismo dialectico, terrible. Alain Badiou, une trajectoire polémique, these are separate books, and Marx and Freud in Latin America. He's currently preparing a manuscript entitled After Borges, Literature and Anti-Philosophy, as well as finishing a short book on Marx's correspondence with Arnold Ruge, La Révolution de la Honte. Bruno is also the translator of several tremendously important books by Alain Badiou and has really helped us understand the importance of this previously relatively overlooked philosopher. Theory of the Subject, Can Politics Be Thought, followed by An Obscure Disaster on the End of the Truth of State, and What is Anti-Philosophy? Writings on Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Lacan, both for Duke University Press. It's actually absolutely amazing that Bruno is able to write all of these books while translating all of these major tomes at the same time. He's the author of dozens of articles on modern Latin American literature and culture, and on contemporary European philosophy and political theory. The titles of his numerous recent articles amply attest to the range and commitment of his work. So we have Badiou and Hegel. Hegel and America, From Potentiality to Inexistence, Politics as the Art of the Impossible. Untimely Decadence in Latin America, as well as The Melancholic Left, Spectres of 1968 in Mexico and Beyond, and Art, Politics, History, Notes on Badiou and Rancière, amongst many others. So while I can't promise you barbecue, I invite you all to join us for a reception at the AD White House following Bruno's talk on global aesthetics and its discontents. Bruno Bustillos.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Tim Murray, director of the Society for the Humanities, for this very generous invitation, but more particularly for creating at the AD White House what I truly believe is an oasis in our university and in the country for thoughtful discussions, workshops, seminars, and international conferences. And I think that this two-day conference speaks to Tim's extraordinary knowledge, but also the generosity with which he's able to get so many people from all parts of the world to participate on this topic. What I have to say, I will divide this in three parts. Unless I run out of time, then there will be only two parts.
I guess I better get out my watch.
I have it already running. So, and basically, I want to talk about the notion of aesthetic revolution and then give it sort of two rebuttals. One more geopolitical and the other one more theoretical in nature. And since Tim, when he asked me, also suggested very subtly that I spoke about Guillermo Cuitca, whom we tried very hard to bring to Cornell, and he has promised us for many years that he would come, but unfortunately it didn't work out for this time of the year, I will try, if time allows it, to talk a little bit about his work at the very end, turning from literature to painting. The first part is called The Aesthetic Revolution, and I would like to frame this with two epigraphs. The first is from the Chilean poet Vicente Huidobro, from his book Altazor, and it says, Los cuatro puntos cardinales son tres, el sur y el norte. The four cardinal points are three, the south and the north. And the second is a quote from the little manifesto, if you want, the coming insurrection from the Invisible Committee. Today, the West is the GI who dashes into Fallujah on an M1 Abrams tank, listening to heavy metal at top volume. It's a tourist lost on the Mongolian plains, mocked by all, who clutches his credit card as his only lifeline. It's a CEO who swears by the game Go. It's the art lover who wants us to be awestruck before the modern genius of a century of artists, from surrealism to Viennese actionism, all competing to see who could best spit in the face of civilization. In a recent article titled The Aesthetic Revolution and Its Outcomes, first published in New Left Review, but taking up ideas from his 2004 book, Malaise dans l'esthétique, translated under the title Aesthetics and Its Discontents, Jacques Rancière summarizes much of his ongoing work on the relation between art and politics by highlighting the different scenarios, or emplotments, as he calls them, for imagining how in the modern age life might become subsumed into art, or conversely, how art might be dissolved back into life. The true side of the so-called aesthetic revolution, however, lies in the space in between these two sides of the dialectic, insofar as it relies neither on the critique of alienated or damaged life in the name of art's autonomy, that alone would hold the promise of happiness, nor on the critique of the institution of art in the name of a revolution of everyday life. Instead, at a more fundamental level, the revolution in question presupposes a blurring of the very distinction between art and non-art. As we can read in Aesthetics and Its Discontents, which is obviously a play on Freud's text, Civilization and Its Discontents, the property of being a thing of art refers to a distinction among ways of doing, not to a distinction among ways of doing, but to a distinction among ways of being. This is what aesthetic means. The property of being art in the aesthetic regime is not given on the basis of criteria of technical perfection, but by the assignation of a certain form of sensible apprehension. Here and elsewhere, as in the article for New Left Review, Rancière is fond of illustrating the effects of this process with a reference to the Bazar de Curiosité from the opening pages of Balzac's 1831 novel, La Peau de Chagrin, The Wild Ass's Skin. In the showrooms of the different floors of this curiosity shop, all kinds of objects, gadgets, booklets, and other commodities from around the world are put on display, mingled with works of art, relics, old statues and various paintings, both famous and unknown. For Rancière, this motley confusion is suggestive of the fact that henceforth, as a result of the aesthetic revolution that breaks with the ethical and representational canons for the distribution of genres and styles, any object whatsoever can cross the border between art and non-art and back. This is from the article. The old curiosity shop makes the Museum of Fine Arts and the Ethnographic Museum equivalent. And keep this statement in mind, I'll come back to this later on. It dismisses the argument of prosaic use or commodification. If the end of art is to become a commodity, the end of a commodity is to become art. By becoming obsolete, unavailable for everyday consumption, any commodity or familiar article becomes available for art as a body ciphering history and an object of disinterested pleasure. It is re-aestheticized in a new way. The heterogeneous sensible is everywhere. The prose of everyday life becomes a huge, fantastic poem. Any object can cross the border and repopulate the realm of aesthetic experience. As you can see, I'm not as adept as Simon with the PowerPoint. What this seductive paraphrase seems to leave out of the picture, however, is precisely the global dimension of this aesthetic revolution that allows such constant border crossings between art and non-art. In fact, could we even imagine such a thing as a global aesthetic revolution along the lines of Rancière's argument? Or should we perhaps entertain the possibility that the global and the aesthetic, in this precise sense, are profoundly and systematically at loggerheads, each notion being internally divided and separated from the other by sharp antagonisms that give the lie to the illusion of boundless flow and availability? In fact, as Simone also reminded me, the contrarian spirit that I am, I first thought of giving this talk the title, Neither Global Nor Aesthetic. What is at stake in raising these questions is not just a matter to be solved with the knee-jerk reaction of demanding the inclusion of more regions, different examples, or other references from beyond the confines of Western Europe. To be sure, by and large, the encounter in question is limited to France and Germany, with examples drawn from Balzac to Mallarmé to Duchamp, and the philosophical framework from Schiller to Adorno to Lyotard. But at the same time, the idea seems to be that this argument for a so-called aesthetic regime in the distribution of the sensible, a distribution in which art and non-art constantly collide and exchange roles, could easily be extended and transposed as is onto other regions or areas, perhaps even including the Third World. Are we confident, though, that such a transposition is feasible without troubling the conceptual scaffolding that supports it? Must not the logic of the aesthetic revolution itself undergo substantial changes as soon as we include the global dynamics of center and periphery, empire and colony, north and south? More so than the corrective of tokenism, then, what would be needed is a qualitative shift in our understanding of the politics of aesthetics in the age of globalization. To illustrate the nature of this shift, and before coming back to the 19th century, let me leap forward in time and take a closer look at another motley collection of objects and artifacts, this time taken from Alejo Carpentier's 1949 novella, El Reino de Este Mundo, The Kingdom of This World. I am referring to the scene from the opening chapter, titled Las Cabezas de Cera, in which the slave, Tinoel, lets his gaze fall on the wax heads on the shelf, standing at the entrance of the barber's shop, where his master is receiving a clean morning shave. While his master was being shaved, Tinoel could gaze his fill at the four wax heads that adorned the counter by the door. The curls of the wigs, opening into a pool of ringlets on the red base, framed expressionless faces. Those heads seemed as real, although their fixed stare was so dead, as a talking head an itinerant mountebank had brought to the cap years before to promote the sale of an elixir for curing toothache and rheumatism. Immediately after this first description, our reader's gaze is pulled sideways, together with Tinoel's, toward the objects on display at the shop next door, separated from the wax hats at the barber's only by a thin wooden panel, easily crossed by the old slave's wandering imagination. By an amusing coincidence, in the window of the tripe shop next door, There were calf's heads, skinned, and each with a sprig of parsley across the tongue, which possessed the same waxy quality. They seemed asleep among the pickled oxtails, calf's foot jelly, and pots of tripe à la mode de Caen. Only a wooden wall separated the two counters, and it amused Tinoel to think that alongside the pale calf's heads, heads of white men were served on the same tablecloth. Just as fowl for a banquet are adorned with their feathers, so some experienced macabre cook might have trimmed the heads with their best wigs. All that was lacking was a border of lettuce leaves or radishes cut in the shape of lilies. Finally, and although even for a distracted reader, this explicit addition may already turn out to be unnecessary and overly didactic, a third exhibit of heads, also perhaps about to be severed, comes to us in the guise of a series of prints recently arrived from Paris. The morning was rampant with heads, for next to the tripe shop, the bookseller had hung on a wire with clothespins the latest prints received from Paris. At least four of them displaced the face of the King of France in a border of suns, swords, and laurel. But Tinoel's attention was attracted at that moment, sorry for that, by a copper engraving, the last of the series, which differed from the others in subject and treatment. It represented a kind of French admiral or ambassador being received by a Negro framed by feather fans and seated upon a throne adorned with figures of monkeys and lizards. "What kind of people are those?" he boldly inquired of the bookseller, who was lighting a long clay pipe in the doorway of his shop. "That is a king of your country." Everything, in a sense, is here as suggested by Rancière. First, the mixing of art and non-art, the high and the low, culture and tribes. Then the thresholds and thin walls unable to contain or control the flow of commodities. And finally, even the desacralizing, emancipatory effects of the sheer juxtaposition of this heterogeneous sensible, which threatens to bring down kings, hang or decapitate the nobility, and render visible the empty place of power, waiting to be occupied by the black Jacobins of Haiti, which in the final instance is a topic of Carpentier's entire novel. And yet, at the same time, one cannot avoid the impression that so much more is visible in the distribution of the sensible according to the kingdom of the world than in the curiosity shop where Balzac's hero, Raphael, who at this point is still referred to only as the young man or the unknown one, will eventually purchase his shrinking wild ass's skin. Or to be more precise, much more is visible in the treatment that Carpentier, and even for that matter Balzac himself, give to these opening scenes than in the way the curiosity shop from La Peau de Chagrin repeatedly comes to serve as a quintessential illustration of the aesthetic revolution in the eyes of Rancière. In fact, if now we look back from the colonial periphery to the modern aesthetic revolution that allegedly takes place in the metropolis, can we not see signs of discontent that gnaw away at the narrative presented to us with such persuasive force from within the confines of Western Europe? For all its emancipatory promise, what this narrative seems to leave unremarked, if not openly disavows, is the violence of primitive accumulation and colonial expropriation, without which the aesthetic revolution would not even have been possible in the first place. The question, therefore, is not so much whether we can imagine a global aesthetic revolution that would do for other parts of the world what Balzac's curiosity shop revealed so brilliantly for Europe, but rather the more pertinent question is, how can we possibly continue to imagine an aesthetic revolution without taking into account the practices of colonial and imperialist expansion that enable it and quite possibly even threaten it with collapse? If at this point I may be allowed to put Rancière in the company of a rather strange bedfellow, much can still be learned about the geopolitics of the so-called aesthetic revolution by turning to the brutally clairvoyant final works of Carl Schmitt. In The Nomos of the Earth especially, Schmitt gives us a most realistic account of the constitution of the first truly global world order as a result of the appropriations of land in the Americas. The new global image, resulting from the circumnavigation of the Earth and the great discoveries of the 15th and 16th century, Schmitt writes, required a new spatial order Thus began the epoch of modern international law that lasted until the 20th century. According to Schmidt, in fact, no properly global order exists before this era, which marks a 400-year period of European international law, the so-called Jus Publicum Europaeum. All pre-global orders were essentially terrestrial, even if they encompassed sea powers and thalassocracias. The original terrestrial world was altered in the Age of Discovery, when the Earth first was encompassed and measured by the global consciousness of European peoples. This resulted in the first nomos of the Earth. It was based on a particular relation between the spatial order of firm land and the spatial order of free sea, and for 400 years it supported a Eurocentric international law, the Jus Publicum Europaeum. It began with the discovery of a new world and the start of the modern age, and kept pace with the development of geographical maps and of the globe itself. The word global captures the encompassing and planetary, as well as the external and superficial character of this type of thinking, based on the equation of land and sea surfaces. And parenthetically, it's obvious that this does not simply begin in 1492. For Schmidt, this global order starts to unravel around 1890, that is, around the times of the Congo Conference, held in 1885 in Berlin under Bismarck, the Sino-Japanese War of 1894, which signals the emergence of Japan as a new East Asian great power, and the Spanish-American War of 1898, which marks the beginning of world dominance of the United States. Without in any way subscribing to the obscure ideological operation that is at work in the nomos of the earth, I mean, basically, Schmidt is trying to sort of inscribe the justice of this world order within the very ground of the earth. Two aspects in particular are worth noting in Schmidt's account of globalization. The first concerns what he calls global linear thinking, that is, the distribution of order and chaos according to several types of lines running across the globe. Three types, to be precise. First, the so-called rayas, lines or strokes, established under the Pope's authority in bulls or treaties, such as the ones from Tordesillas, 1494, or Saragossa, 1526, to separate the territorial claims of Spain and Portugal. Second, the French and English tradition of amity lines, for example, the one established by a secret clause of the Treaty of Cateau-Cambrésis in 1559, separating Catholic land-appropriating powers and Protestant sea powers from the non-Christian free zones where a Hobbesian state of nature reigned and man was, in fact, a wolf to other men. And third, in what for Schmidt is already the beginning of the end, the line separating the so-called Western Hemisphere, above all the United States, not from Asia or the East, but from the Old West, that is, from Old Europe, or Europe, which now becomes the Old West, as opposed to the New West of the Western Hemisphere. What the global order drawn up along these lines enables is, above all, a bracketing of war and conflict within the borders of Europe. And this is the second important aspect, I think, that we should take from Schmidt's Nomos of the Earth. While the law of the strongest ruled beyond the line, for example, religious and other civil wars could be avoided on this side of the line within Europe, as war among European states became juridically formalized as an inter-European war among sovereign states who recognized each other as such, precisely in opposition to the state of nature, now physically and geographically located on the other side of the amity line. For Schmidt, this is a major, almost miraculous accomplishment of Eurocentric international law. A rationalization, humanization, and legalization, a bracketing of war, was achieved against this background of global lines. At least with respect to continental land war in European international law, this was achieved by limiting war to a military relation between states. Basically, personalized sovereign states act as lords in a duel among European world powers recognizing themselves as sovereign states with a formal game of war, as opposed to the savage order of force that reigns on the other side. It is in this light, for example, that we can read the meaning of the French and English notion of amity lines. The significance of amity lines in 16th and 17th century international law was that great areas of freedom were designated as conflict zones in the struggle over the distribution of a new world. And of course, unwillingly, you know, Rancière never refers to this. You can hear sort of Rancièrean impulse in Schmitt's otherwise brutally honest account of Eurocentric imperialism. As a practical justification, one could argue that the designation of a conflict zone at once freed the area on this side of the line in Europe, a sphere of peace and order ruled by European public law, 200 years without religious or creedal wars, from the immediate threat of those events beyond the line, which would not have been the case had there been no such zone. The designation of a conflict zone outside Europe contributed also to the bracketing of European wars, which is its meaning and its justification in international law. This is an operation in which, for Schmitt, of course, because of a professional deformation, jurists were extremely important in formulating the legal and juridical framework for this type of bracketing of the war within Europe at the cost, obviously, of the projection of destruction and devastation on the other side of the line. Should we not reflect upon the consequences of the necessary concomitance of these practices, the drawing of lines that simultaneously produces a bracketing of war within and a flaring up of agonal conflict and destruction without, for the thinking of global aesthetics? Could we not argue that the aesthetic revolution, which in the 19th century blurs the distinction of art and non-art, happens only in Europe on this side of the various rayas and amity lines that separate Europe from the so-called free zones beyond the line, ready to be appropriated and colonized? In other words, Europe, you know, to put it metaphorically, is closing off its border, and then from within those borders, art and non-art can become indistinguishable, and this does have emancipatory potential, but the cost of this is obviously invisible unless we look beyond those global lines. What are we as critics, art historians, artists, or theorists supposed to do in the face of this ominous interpretive possibility? As a modest contribution to this question, I propose to focus on the period of the end of the 19th century, when we might say that on the one hand, the aesthetic revolution reaches a peak in the sphere of fin de siècle decadence and aestheticism, while on the other hand, the Eurocentric nomos of the earth, which, after having known a period of what Schmitt calls optimism, between 1870 and 1890, that is the high period of imperialism, begins to crumble in the wake of the 1885 Congo Conference, which Schmitt labels as the last great act of a common European international law. Right? A juridical framework for the appropriation of non-European soil by Europe, the so-called scramble for Africa. The difficulty of the task of the critic, and thus for me the whole challenge, lie precisely in the fact that the art and literature of this period only rarely, if ever, give us a glimpse of the violent process of drawing amity lines, without which, in my eyes, no aesthetic revolution could ever have taken place. By way of a literary image, I could illustrate this with a late 19th century pendant to Balzac's curiosity shop. Before providing the goods that will come to populate the public dream world of the arcades, so famously studied by Walter Benjamin and after him by Susan Buck Morse, the impulse behind Balzac's curiosity shop in a way reaches a grand summa in the private abode of Des Esseintes, the decadent hero of Joris Karl Huysmans' 1884 novel A Rebours, right, Against Nature. Even in this most extreme of artificial paradises, the sound of daily labor in and around the house constantly threatens to interrupt the phantasmagoric accumulation of decadent art, liquor, and literature. Therefore, when Des Esseintes decides to invite the two old servants who had looked after his mother until she died to come and work for him in his secluded villa in Fontenay-aux-Roses in the suburbs of Paris, he has to insist on a series of stratagems to ensure that to the best of their ability, they make themselves not just invisible, but also inaudible. The husband's duty was to clean the rooms and go marketing, the wife to do all the cooking. The Sassan gave up the first floor of the house to them, but he made them wear thick felt slippers, had the doors fitted with tambours and their hinges well oiled, and covered the floors with long pile carpeting to make sure that he never heard the sound of their footsteps overhead. You know, of course, there's a sign that sort of accumulates all the sort of a museum, a personal museum of artworks and commodities from all around the globe, but this comes at the price of having to sort of seal off any noise coming from overhead. In sum, when it comes to understanding the aesthetic revolution from a global perspective, all I am asking, in a sense, is that literary critics, art historians, and critical theorists do not in turn put on thick felt slippers, that we try instead to hear the creaking of the doors when all of a sudden and for a brief while they open up onto the outside or even become unhinged, and that we attune our ears to listen to the muffled sound of footstep, not just above our heads, but also next door and on the other side of the amity lines that enclose Western Europe. For me personally, such an approach became inevitable no sooner than I tried to tackle this problematic from the opposite end of the globe by taking a closer look at one particular moment in the larger aesthetic revolution initiated in the 19th century, namely the moment of decadence, dandyism, and fin de siècle aestheticism, in order to see how this moment takes shape across the Atlantic in Latin America. So this is the second part. That becomes shorter and shorter. So, now, among contemporary critics, well, let me give a brief epigraph from Celia Molloy in an important study on Oscar Wilde and his reception in Latin America. She says, "Latin Americans admire Huysmans. They do not or cannot rewrite him." Now, among contemporary critics, there exists a strong tendency to take the study of decadence in Latin America, like that of other terms of cultural periodization, such as modernism, the avant-garde, or postmodernism, to be an unmistakable sign of Eurocentrism. It would mean, once again, to reduce what is most authentic in Latin American culture of the period, roughly between 1885 and 1910, to being a pale and belated mimicry of the original cosmopolitan models of decadence, which, as usual, are found primarily in Paris and in London. In fact, this argument only reiterates the reasoning with which decadent tendencies in art and literature are rejected from the beginning in Latin America. What is more, insofar as the style of decadence is already perceived to revolve around self-conscious artifice, it is easy to understand why accusations against his being an unnatural excrescence of otherwise wholesome concerns could only become all the more virulent in the case of Latin America. One further corollary of this argument, though, is a refusal to consider the actual exchanges during this period between Europe and Latin America, otherwise than as further confirmation of the ongoing struggle between center and periphery, as if the traumas of dependency prolonged themselves deeply into the hearts of even the best-intended comparatists of the present. What is thereby lost is the inner dynamic of phenomena such as decadence, and the specific ways in which they unfold in Latin America, but also, as a matter of fact, in Europe. I would thus suggest that we address not just the undeniable dominance of these Eurocentric period terms, but also the blinding effects of an all-too-rash critique of them, which by a kind of overcompensation continues to leave the study of European decadence in a realm of its own, wholly cut off from its ties to the non-European or non-Western world. In other words, if you study decadence in Latin America, you're being Eurocentric, and if you study decadence in Europe, you never have to worry about what goes on beyond Europe. So we're at a dead end, right? And the critique of Eurocentrism does not help, because it still leaves these realms in separate spheres, beyond sort of the call for token examples from different regions. But in fact, I would argue that European decadence itself cannot be understood purely and simply on its own terms. Rather, to grasp the sense of decadence requires that we also take into account the legacy and crisis of national traditions from a global perspective. Charles Baudelaire gives us an early glimpse of the kind of comparatism that would be needed to understand this dialectic of the national and the global. Dandyism, Baudelaire writes in The Painter of Modern Life, first published in 1863, appears above all in periods of transition, when democracy is not yet all-powerful and aristocracy is only just beginning to totter and fall. In the disorder of these times, certain men who are socially, politically, and financially ill at ease, you know, quelques hommes déclassés, dégoûtés, désœuvrés, but are all rich in native energy, may conceive the idea of establishing a new kind of aristocracy, all the more difficult to shatter, as it will be based on the most precious, the most enduring faculties, and on the divine gift which work and money are unable to bestow. Dandyism is the last spark of heroism amid decadence. But Baudelaire is quick to provide an odd-seeming example that undoes the logic according to which decadence would be tied to an awareness of events taking place exclusively on the political and artistic scenes of a declining old world. Since he adds that the type of dandy discovered by our traveler in North America does nothing to invalidate this idea. For how can we be sure that those tribes which we call savage may not in fact be the disjecta membra, the debris, of great extinct civilizations? Belying the trend toward the autonomy of pure artifice, decadence and dandyism here become placeholders of a gaze that begins to look at itself through the eyes of the other, a gaze staring back at modern civilization from its perceived outside, from a place which is not its dark and long-forgotten origin, so much as the constitutive promise of its own savage future. It is here, in actual fact, that the exchange between the Fine Arts Museum and the Ethnographic Museum truly begins to take place. Because as long as Europe is still standing in the position of the spectator, there is no true exchange between the Museum of Natural History, the Ethnographic Museum, or the Fine Arts Museum. But it is only when Europe starts to entertain the possibility that it itself may occupy the display or the diorama in a Natural History Museum that we get to a forceful critique of the so-called class of civilization within an imperialist colonial framework. Using the example of the tribal dandy from North America, evidently inspired by Chateaubriand, Baudelaire is undermining the historicist prejudice according to which decadence would have to be read from within the frame of a linear anthropological meta-narrative, that is, as the fatal endpoint of progress from savagery to barbarism to civilization. Even the alternative of a cyclical temporality, which frequently supports the figure of decadence, is beginning to unravel here. Indeed, behind all such images of time and development, whether linear or cyclical, there nevertheless is supposed to lie a stable principle of contemporaneity, or a notion of the now, which at the same time would provide a normative point of comparison between them. But Baudelaire's readers cannot continue relying on a single standard of development, including its necessary stages. Instead, radically different temporalities are literally thrown together with relics and debris of past civilizations into a purely conjunctural presence for which decadence, like modernity, is then only one name among others. Both progress and decline, in other words, are subjected to a unique anti-historicist attack, as Benjamin would later argue in dialogue with Baudelaire. Overcoming the concept of progress and overcoming the concept of period of decline or decadence are two sides of one and the same thing, Benjamin writes, or at least, and such is the double task that applies to the historical materialist who is willing to retrieve the violence and discontent that applies contained in any document of victorious civilization. And just as such a document, Benjamin continues, is not free of barbarism, barbarism taints also the manner in which it was transmitted from one owner to another. A historical materialism, therefore, dissociates himself from it as far as possible. He regards it as his task to brush history against the grain. And what I'm trying to suggest, obviously, is that there's an echo of Arabour, of reading history against the grain, in this notion of the critique of historicism in Baudelaire and Benjamin. In Baudelaire's case, to brush history against the grain means to follow the counterintuitive scenarios of mirroring and internal splitting when basic ideological tenets from the turn of the century are twisted and dislodged along their voyage across the Atlantic, with the ocean now functioning as a deforming mirror for endless operations of transference and counter-transference. Baudelaire's pseudo-anthropological dandy from the tribe in North America, in this sense, could well be compared to the inverse figure of a certain Indio who knows French, who makes a one-time appearance at the end of the Cuban writer José Martí's only novel, Lucía Jerez. From the shores of Latin America, the very untimeliness of the notion of decadence, like that of the aesthetic revolution writ large, cannot fail to be understood as a sign of uneven development. But then the logic of uneven development, far from affecting only peripheral societies, must be generalized, as even Marx came to understand, albeit very late in his life, too late in any event, to make amends with a continent for which, because of its love of Bonapartism, Marx famously never had any real revolutionary hopes. Starting in the 1870s, when he reads up on the cases of Ireland, Russia, Poland, Turkey, and India, however, Marx did begin to formulate a series of hypotheses that enabled him to generalize a logic of contingent and uneven development for the entire capitalist world, and not only for the so-called peripheral, backward, semi-capitalist, or colonial countries. But he never took full advantage of these hypotheses in order to take a fresh look at Latin America. Martí, on the other hand, who seems to have returned the favor by criticizing Marx in a necrological note, can be our guide in carrying the logic of uneven development onto a global scale so as to include phenomena of decadence and disjointedness within a world historical comparatist frame. In Lucía Jerez, his 1885 novel, also known under the title Amistad Funesta, the Cuban writer actually comes close to anticipate many of Marx's later writings about the universal nature of uneven development. "These times of ours are out of joint," Martí writes, "and with the collapse of the old social walls and the refinements of education, a new and vast class of aristocrats of the mind has emerged, imbued with all the showy needs and rich tastes that come with it, without there having been sufficient time in the rapidness of the turnabout for the change in the organization and distribution of fortunes to correspond to the brutal alteration in the social relations produced by political liberties and by the vulgarization of knowledge." In Spanish, this actually reads like a completely fluent sentence. In Martí's novel, this logic of uneven development based on a structural lack of correspondence at all levels of society in the first place affects the life of intellectuals. Since with our Spanish-American heads filled with ideas from Europe and North America, we find ourselves in our countries in the manner of fruits without a market, like excrescences of the earth that weigh down on it and disturb it, and not as its natural flourishing, it so happens that those who possess intelligence, which is sterile among us due to its ill guidance, finding themselves in need of making it fertile so as simply to subsist, devoted with exclusive excess to the political battles, in the noblest of cases, thus producing an imbalance between the scarce country and the political surfeit. Or else, pressured by the urgencies of life, they serve the strong man in power who pays and corrupts them, or they strive to topple him when, bothered by needy newcomers, he withdraws his abundant payment for their baneful services. Servicios funestos. Right? Thus, the very funest, baneful, or ill-fated nature of the mysterious friendship alluded to in the novel's original title, Amistad Funesta, would somehow be related to the disastrously imbalanced outcomes of uneven development. Indeed, the only other two references in the novel to the element of lo funesto also allude to the effects of a structural mismatch or maladjustment. I'll skip these examples, but basically they talk about characters that also show either in their intelligence or their way of dress, including a dandy, a similar mismatch. Friendship and love become baneful or funest precisely due to such maladjustments between the life of the mind and the life of the heart, between exaggerated physical beauty and the moral scarcity of the soul, or between the poverty of civil society and the surfeit of politics. Based on mycological models such as these, we could expand our scope to include the global developments that overdetermine the drama of vacillating national identities and aesthetic regimes for distributing the sensible, not only in Latin America, but in Europe as well. As Jameson also proposes in A Singular Modernity, incidentally, right after a discussion of Spanish-American modernismo, which is the equivalent of late 19th century symbolism, all of this suggests that literary influence looks rather different when, as today, cultural evolution is grasped as a symptom of the dynamics of an international capitalist system. Yet a dialectic does not yet exist that is capable of coordinating the incommensurable conceptualities of the national, literary, and the international. Indeed, one point of entry into this dialectic for thinking global aesthetics would operate precisely via the question of imitation and epigonism mentioned earlier. So I think this could be, in this constant sort of shuttling back and forth between Latin America and Europe, I find that many of the concepts that are seen to be limited to Latin America, when you sort of turn the dart back against Europe, are revealing for literary and artistic history within the confines of Western Europe. Rubén Darío, the self-proclaimed founder of Latin American Modernismo, thus famously asked himself, and originally he said this in French, qui pourrais-je imiter pour être original? Who could I imitate to be original? Even though elsewhere, in another manifesto-like statement, he also quotes Wagner's motto, first of all, do not imitate anybody, especially not me. But the same question of imitation also drives a wedge between France and Germany from Romantic times all the way to the Franco-Prussian War. At the beginning, and to put things abruptly, there is this. Since the collapse of Christianity, a specter has haunted Europe, the specter of imitation, which means, first of all, the imitation of the ancients, Philippe Lacoulabarthe and Jean-Luc Nancy write. Germany's drama even consists in suffering this imitation to the second degree, and in finding itself forced to imitate the imitation of the ancient that France and Italy exported nonstop for at least two centuries. And this is then reduplicated, if you want, the second or third degree in Latin America, so you have to unravel this threat all the way back, I think, into the very heart of Western Europe. The larger dilemma of imitation and epigonism between Latin America and Europe, in other words, is replicated within Europe in such contexts as the ideological battle between Germany and France over who has the more genuine right to claim the legacy of Greek or Roman antiquity. Nietzsche's own notion of untimeliness, Unzeitgemäßigkeit, which, as I hope to have suggested before, is precisely an attempt to think the present as disjointed or unhinged from all linear or cyclical models of time, emerges, after all, in this very same embattled context. Or is it actually the case that we Germans, to leave the Romance nations out of account, must always be no more than hares in all the higher affairs of culture, because that is all we can ever be? What I mean by this, and it is all that I mean, is that the thought of being epigones, which can often be a painful thought, is also capable of evoking great effects and grand hopes for the future in both an individual and a nation, provided we regard ourselves as the heirs and successors of the astonishing powers of antiquity and see in this our honor and our spur. Finally, even the efforts at historical periodization themselves, including the typical 19th century project to write a world history, from Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of history all the way to their scathing parody in the second of Nietzsche's own untimely meditations, can be seen as attempts to overcome the problems that derive from the need and eventually the failure of colonial powers, both ideologically and philosophically, to legitimize their rule in the name of universal reason or humanity. Of course, as most decadent writers were acutely aware, this is not unlike what happened many centuries earlier with the collapse of the Roman Empire, when Augustine, in City of God, produced what is perhaps the first truly world historical account of decadence and regeneration in response to the ideological crisis opened up in the aftermath of the sack of Rome. Perhaps then today we should rather be surprised that anyone can still present an intellectual history of decadence as a culminating point of the aesthetic revolution without taking into account the violent and unequal legacy of colonial expansion. This is even the case, for example, of the late Charles Bernheimer's otherwise brilliant book, Decadent Subjects, The Idea of Decadence in Art, Literature, Philosophy, and Culture of the Fin de Siècle in Europe, which never leaves the confines of Western Europe. A rare exception in this regard is Alain Badiou, quoted earlier today, who in the century reads La Belle Époque as inseparable from colonial barbarity. Speaking of the creative splendor of the two great decades between 1890 and 1914, and the enigma of their relation to the savagery of the war of 1914 to 1918, Badiou writes, "There is no hope of resolving this problem unless we keep in mind that the blessed period before the war is also that of the apogee of colonial conquest, of Europe's stranglehold over the entirety of the earth, or very nearly. And therefore, that elsewhere, far away but also very close to everyone's conscience, in the midst of every family, servitude and massacre are already present." Late 19th century decadence and the critique of historicism, like the aesthetic revolution described by Rancière, from the larger perspective that seems unavoidable to me as a Latin Americanist, do not emerge as the result of post-1848 or post-1870 conflicts within or between Germany and France, so much as they are a last-hour response to the eruption of scandalous truths that forever will have put into crisis the entire imperial project of Europe. And yet, even this call for a new comparative approach to the question of global aesthetics opens itself up to a familiar set of objections. Am I not, in fact, limiting myself to a critical operation of confronting literature and aesthetics with the discomforting truth or the guilty conscience of the material conditions that constitute their outside? Worse, am I not thereby losing sight of the very essence of the so-called aesthetic function? In the end, and no matter how politically valid or urgent it may well be, does not such an external approach fail to appreciate the opacity and negativity that would be inherent in art and aesthetics? To answer these objections, and before concluding with an example from the realm of painting, I would like to turn one last time to Jacques Rancière, more specifically to that little gem of a book that is his Mallarmé, La Politique de la Sirène, Mallarmé, The Politics of the Siren, which is soon to appear in English. Rancière himself, as a matter of fact, begins this book with a forceful rebuttal of previously existing readings of Mallarmé's oeuvre in terms of some obscure secret or spiritual adventure witnessed by the poet in the dark night of reason. You know, Rancière is never very modest about dismissing pretty much every other existing reading of Mallarmé, and he states very clearly from the beginning that Mallarmé should not be seen as the witness to anything whatsoever outside of his poetry. Instead, we are invited to adopt a rule proffered by the poet himself. There remains, above all, the fundamental rule of Mallarmean poetics, that the poem has value only on the condition that it holds within itself both its light and its night. Using a particularly clever stratagem, this reading promises to inscribe the question of the poem's historicity back into the poem itself. What the siren metaphorizes, what the poem renders effective then, is precisely the event and the calculated risk of the poem in an era and a mental environment that are not yet ready to welcome it. In Rancière's approach, in other words, a poem by Mallarmé becomes itself an articulation or a set of hypotheses about the link between the poetic act or the aesthetic event that it stages and the era in which such an act or event takes place, either so as to vanish back into the flow of everyday opinion and universal reportage, or else so as to withdraw itself in a slight but significant deviation from the expectations of its own time and place. In this way, the question about the historical situatedness of poetry is folded back into the poem. Even though the poet is not supposed to be a witness to anything outside of his poetry, whether in terms of history, biography, or philosophy, it is nevertheless possible to speak in terms of eras, times, epochs, or ages. In the book on Mallarmé alone, we find descriptions of the age of Hegel, the age of the Flaubertian novel, and of course, there is the time or age of Mallarmé himself, which is already described in terms of the aesthetic revolution, as opposed to the time of representation in which symbols and allegories are referred back to stable histories or to fixed characters. Now, before the aesthetic revolution, there's sort of a set of rules that predetermine what genres or style correspond to certain topics or certain characters, which is what the aesthetic revolution upsets by blurring the very definition of art. Here's one such example of the shift introduced into the regime of representation by the aesthetic revolution of Mallarmé's time, as seen in Un coup de dé, a throw of the dice. The decor put in place is the one we already know from before, the race of the ship of poetry on the ocean of the time. In Vigny's time, one threw it in it the bottle of the poetic message, written in Alexandrines, destined for a posterity charged with the same task as any other posterity, to retrieve the heritage of the ideal that its time failed to recognize. In the time of Mallarmé, one has forgotten the maneuver, lost along with the ancient scansion of the Alexandrine, sabotaged by the followers of the uneven verse and the free verse carried to its tomb by the Hugolian ogre. Clearly, this is neither an argument for autonomy, nor are we condemned to dwell in the night of languages in transitive negativity, as in the tradition of Maurice Blanchot. Instead, poetry stages, so to speak, a second-degree relation to its very own historicity. The politics of the dice throw and the ultimate meaning of the fable of the ship and the siren must be understood in this way, Rancière writes. The conditions do not yet exist for the union of the poet and the crowd in the hymn of spiritual hearts. The extraordinary hour, l'heure extraordinaire, has not come, nor the prodigious hall identical to the stage. This paradoxical inscription of history into the poem's self-emblematization is further compounded if we address the issue of a second relation, namely the relation of the poet or the poem to the act of thinking that takes place within the poem. And here, the presupposition of immanence on the critic's part seems to be at its strongest. Mallarmé bids farewell to the art of representation and to the idea as model, but he maintains a mimetic status for the poem, Rancière posits. The poem does not imitate any model, but it sensibly traces the movement of the idea as the movement of its own bursting forth. So there's a sort of an inherent theorization of the poem that also propounds the theory of its own poeticity. There is thus, strictly speaking, no separation between the poem and the thinking of the poem. Quote, the fact remains that if there is a thought of the poem, it lies in the oscillating movement that gathers all these possibles in a single fold, that fold of somber lace which retains the infinite, which sums them up in a single gesture and makes of this gesture of doubt and hyperbole a ritual and the very emblem of the consecration of the play of being human. The key category in the articulation of this relation between poetry and thought is that of the aesthetic or poetic act. You know, related to the question of the aesthetic function in the flyer for the conference. Of course, we are all supposed to be familiar with Mallarmé's own definitions of the act. Definitions such as this one from Music and Letters in Divagation. Nature has taken place. It can't be added to, except for cities or railroads or other inventions where we change the form but not the fact of our material. The one available act forever and alone is to understand the relations, in the meantime, few or many, according to some interior state that one wishes to extend in order to simplify the world. In Rancière's hands, however, the notion of the act serves above all to render the operations of thought imminent to the poem's own operations. More importantly, the whole aim of this reading seems to consist in confirming the paradoxical hypothesis of an aesthetic revolution in which Mallarmé, that purest of poets, can simultaneously appear as the epitome of art's emancipatory promise. Even the pure poet, par excellence, Mallarmé, Rancière writes, confides to poetry the task of organizing another topography of commonalities, preparing the festivities of the future. Rancière insists that Mallarmé can pick up on any object, of any sort of mundane object, and put it to work in the search for a future art that would be up to par to the theater or the stage that he foresees for these festivities of the future. Rancière writes in Aesthetics and His Discontents, before indicating a surprising proximity in this regard between the author of A Throw of the Dice and the arts and craft movement in the USA, or the industrial origins of Bauhaus or the Werkbund, you know, usually not associated with Mallarmé. Quote, the pure poet Mallarmé and the engineers of the Werkbund from a distance share the idea of an art capable of producing, by suppressing its own singularity, the concrete forms of a community that would finally have exited from the appearances of democratic formalism. So this is the ultimate goal, obviously, of Rancière's notion of the aesthetic revolution, that this emancipatory potential is kept even in the case of such pure or abstract writers as Flaubert and Mallarmé. The theoretical question with which I would like to conclude, however, is the exact nature of the act or gesture with which artists in the age of the aesthetic regime are supposed to be able to poeticize the everyday, all the while letting the world of objects and commodities become unavailable due to the law of planned obsolescence. Could we not say that even when Mallarmé, in the act of simplifying the world by understanding its few or many relations according to some mental state that one wishes to extend, is also describing the very precise moment of the subject's capture by ideology? Is not the act of inscribing a minimal gap, which is the gesture of defamiliarization common to the gaze of Balzac's hero in The Wild Ass's Skin, no less than to Brechtian theater or to modern-day installation art, the act of ideology at its purest? This might be true also for as traditional an artistic medium as painting. Take, for instance, some of the basic shifts in the work of the Argentine painter Guillermo Cuitca. Cuitca's early works, such as the series of paintings El Mar Dulce from the mid-80s, thus typically revolve around the Oedipal drama of the psychoanalytical family romance. They recall the damage caused by a forbidden passion, or else secretly allude to an act of originary violence. Toward the end of the 80s, however, in works such as Nordrhein or San Juan de la Cruz, with series such as Burning Beds, and then with the Tablada Suite, or Castle to Castle, from the Neufeld Suite, Cuitca begins to distance himself from the dramatic slant of his first works, erasing all human presence, to the extent that this is possible, leaving only a trace of its ephemeral passage or signposts of its imminent arrival. He unfolds the purely anonymous force of multiple spaces, both private and public, apartment layouts, road maps, city maps, architectural plans. From the child-sized beds to the map of heavenly stars, he constructs an open catalog of spaces and places as the grounds for the practice of everyday life. Far removed from the melodramatic intensity of his theatrical works, the artist now opts for the sober perspective of a kind of disenchanted anthropologist of late modernity. Like Georges Perec in Espèces d'espace, Species of Spaces, he seems to concern himself with a single compulsive question. What does it mean to inhabit a place? Following Gilles Deleuze in Essays Critical and Clinical, we could describe this shift as the difference between two fundamental orientations of art, which in turn coincide with two radically opposed notions of the unconscious. The first, which obsessively revolves around the uncanny return of traumas from times immemorial, and the second, which from all sides looks ahead towards a future of unpredictable and unheard of possibilities. The first orientation can be called archaeological, and the second cartographic. And I quote from Deleuze, there is not only a reversal of directions, but also a difference in nature, The unconscious no longer deals with persons and objects, but with trajectories and becomings. It is no longer an unconscious of commemoration, but one of mobilization, an unconscious whose objects take flight rather than remaining buried in the ground. End quote. Time in this case is not something one shoulders like a tragic destiny, but something that can be activated and transformed, giving one more turn of the screw to the logic of the law and vengeful repetition. Whereas the subject, instead of narrowly sticking to the theater of its own psychogenesis, participates in a slow process of becoming imperceptible. Or alternatively, this time following Deleuze's account of the shift in Michel Foucault's work, we could describe the displacement in Quidca's art as a shift from the archive to the diagram. Quote from Deleuze, "The diagram is no longer the auditory or visual archive, but a map, a cartography that is coextensive with the entire social field." Quidca likewise reinterprets the theatricalized archive of the visible and the sayable from the angle of power struggles that divide the entire social territory. Instead of the microphone, the tape recorder, or the light projector, the new space offers only an architectural or cartographic surface of inscription, an abstract machine for subjecting homogeneous and indifferent individuals to the diagram of society. You have to sort of see also how this intermediate stages, this is one of the theatrical stage settings. Much of this is based on his work with Pina Bausch, whom he went to visit and traveled with her in Europe. And you can see some of the similar props of the chairs and the beds, and very often the dramatic element of sort of the eventfulness of these paintings is related to the burning of the beds. But already on the wall, as though painted on the back wall, you can see the floor plan, as though you will sort of move up to a bird's eye perspective. And this floor plan will then acquire autonomy. So you get a new series of these one-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment floor plans. Similarly, from El Mar Dulce, we get this sort of isolated element of the carriage from Battleship Potemkin, Eisenstein movie, acquiring autonomy and then being overlaid on a map to produce a painting, perhaps one of the most succinct works in Quidca's oeuvre, called Odessa. Right? We get the superposition, of course, of Battleship Potemkin, which is reinscribed into the Oedipal drama of the mother seeing her baby carriage tumbling down the stairs, but constantly sort of shuttling back and forth between politics and the more psychoanalytical concerns. From the pseudo-privacy of the domestic space, through the antagonisms that mark the demise of the nation, all the way to the new global order in its permanent state of emergency, Quidca's work delves into the predicaments of territoriality that define the various forms of late modern or postmodern subjectivity: individual, citizen, group, class, multitude, generic humanity. This is Odessa. Quidca's recent work does not have to choose, but rather combines, juxtaposes, and more frequently superimposes the diagram with the archive, theatricality with architecture, art as cartography with art as archaeology. What is common to both orientations, however, is an emphasis on working in series, not only in the sense that Quidca always seems to want to exhaust the possibilities of an abstract scheme to the extreme inner limit where the series just snaps, but also insofar as all of his work can be seen as an ongoing struggle within painting against the effects of seriality. In shows from the 1990s, such as Puro Teatro or the Tablada Suite, many of these are first shown in the Sperone Westwater Gallery in New York City, and I think it's important to sort of keep in mind the display of these installations. Usually 9 or 14 paintings of the same type would be combined in the gallery so as to contrast them with the exception of a singular and uniquely figurative or theatrical work. Novelty thus emerges retroactively as the effect of subtraction or supplementation of this singularity onto the ensemble of the series itself. This is previously you know, you get sort of the projection of the map onto these child-sized beds. This is sort of the catalog of the spaces that I was referring to. This is in the installation that's going on right now in the Bowery Gallery, where in the elevator you get these mattresses that also, of course, form the stage for a theater. This is a painting called Global Order, Map of the Heavens, painted on a queen-size plastic mattress. And these are the works that I want to refer to. This is from Tablada Suite. So you get these institutional floor plans that are drawn from libraries, hospital, prisons, football stadiums, Star Wars, spaceship, and so on, in which, of course, you have this equivalence of the slots assigned to each individual space, the carrel in the library, the bed in the hospital, and so forth. But this series of 9 or 14 paintings of the same type is then, all untitled, is then interrupted by one exception as a return to the theatrical or archaeological type of art. Later, in series such as Poema Pedagógico, the contingency of chance of this event becomes integrated into the rigid diagrammatic frame of the paintings. The theatrical and institutional order of assigned places is then interrupted in a paradoxical gesture of voluntary arbitrariness. For instance, by randomly superimposing various rows of numbered seats, I think because there's so much light, it's hard to see, but this looks like a blackboard in a school, as though it's a chalk drawing on a blackened canvas with sort of the random displacement of an aberrant contingency affecting the numbered seats and rows. Or at least so the artist claims, he obtains this effect by painting blindfolded. All of Kwitka's work, in other words, seeks to locate the chance-like occurrence of an event against and in the midst of the seriality of the practical inert. In our current conjuncture, that's fine, but if I can... I'm almost done, in that case. Well, we can look back at these afterwards if people want. In our current conjuncture, however, the subject is lacking, who could remain loyal to the haphazard nature of such an event. Instead, the space for this subject is systematically left vacant, emptied out of all ideological or sentimental identifications, whether in terms of couple, group, class, or nation. Every gamble and every wager in the new global order always already seems to be diluted and subordinated to the law of money, free only to dance in the chains of this eternal present of capital without a future. These are allusions to some recent paintings, for example, in which using the Neufeld, you know, projections, Kwitka sort of draws the attention to the equivalence between, let's say, the position in a confessional booth and the position in a peep show. Right? So you get these sort of architectural designs of the booths, and of course, structurally, they're entirely equivalent. Or the gambling tables in a casino, and so on, or the gymnasium, which are also architecturally equivalent. The viewers thereby become interpolated. To them befalls the decision whether merely to occupy the individualized slot foreseen for them in the diagrams of society, or else to force the very law of assigned spaces toward a future that is perhaps still to come. Kwitka's body of work could well be summed up as a painterly investigation into the question of how a subject becomes hooked onto a structure, including in the sense of a pathological addiction that is stronger than any individual's free will. Should we not also consider the possibility that the operation by which an individual body, whether the artist's or the public's, comes to occupy this empty place actually marks a moment not of the subject's free will, but rather of his or her inevitable suture? Jacques-Alain Miller defines this operation as follows. Suture names the relation of the subject to the chain of its discourse. We shall see that it figures there as the element which is lacking, in the form of a stand-in. For while there lacking, it is not purely and simply absent. Suture, by extension, names the general relation of lack to the structure of which it is an element, inasmuch as it implies the position of it taking the place of, lieutenant, lieutenant, literally a placeholder. Based on the notion of the poetic or aesthetic act that can be found from Mallarmé to Quidca, I wonder if the necessity of such a suture, which is seen as constitutive of the proper functioning of ideology, does not limit the role of the subject of the aesthetic to that of coming in between, like a placeholder, the work's structure and its event-like excess. What Jacques Lacan used to call point de capiton, that is, the nodal points or upholstering buttons, would then be a more appropriate name for the linkages by which we as aesthetic subjects, even if we are perhaps not as free as we like to think, nevertheless continue to feel invited into the structure of the work of art. This is an early floor plan of Quidca. It's called House Capitonné, a house with point de capiton, if you want, that captures the subject as part of this ideological operation. Thank you very much.
Capiton to the back to Rancière and his reading of Mallarmé, in which you dwell on Rancière's assertion that what's working in Mallarmé is the demonstration of conditions that don't yet exist, insofar as what the poetic or aesthetic act constitutes, if I understood you correctly, is then the materialization in a single fold. And I was wondering how that relation of perhaps a single fold of materials that don't yet exist gets linked to your reading of Quidca in relationship perhaps to the buttons or the point de capiton or this notion of suturing that you bring in.
I mean, this is, the consequences of this point of view are obviously pretty devastating or rather pessimistic, because it seems to suggest that Rancière is trying very hard to make it into a single fold, and to suggest that somehow the poem is giving you its own, not only its own theory or doing its own thinking in the act of producing the poem, but also that it inscribes within the poem its relation to its own time and place. And according to Rancière, insofar as Mallarmé no longer relies on any hierarchical distinction of art and non-art, this can be applied to any everyday object. You know, this is why he favors the examples not of the terms that are charged with traditional poetics of distinction, but rather the everyday objects, you know, the lace or the fan that, in a sense, traces the very movement of a poetic act that is already the emerging into thought of the essence of poetry. And I think that this obliterates the indispensable inscription of a minimal mark, of a gesture that defamiliarizes at least minimally the everyday object into a poetic object, and that inscription of this minimal gap, which I think is a constant all the way into contemporary installation art, no matter how blurred the line between art and non-art is, any artist who takes an everyday object and brings it into the realm of art, or vice versa, relies on this inscription of the artist's own very gesture. And I think that this inscription is also the point where, as subjects, whether viewers or artists, we are caught in the very old paradigm of the subject's freedom to act upon its own conditions of existence in this sort of minimal level of we are free to make history, but not according to conditions of our own choosing. But nevertheless, the understanding is that we are free to inscribe ourselves at a minimal gap or distance from the environment in which what we do takes place. And I think that is the very operation of ideology, namely the inscription of the individual in those empty slots under the idea that we are free to do this with some minimal distance. And I think this goes a long way in explaining the extraordinary success that Salah was talking about before, the skyrocketing numbers. Why are these exhibitions so welcomed, even by Islamophobic West? Because as long as it continues not just the commodification of the female body, but also confirms the basic ideological tenet of our society, which is that as individuals we are free to inscribe ourselves at this minimal distance from our own conditions of existence, we are subjects. Therefore, we are creative artists. And there is nothing, in a sense, emancipatory about that tenet.
Lacan's account of the Point of Capital has a really funny temporality. I mean, on the one hand, he says it's the state against psychosis, right? The whole symbolic field in place and prevents slippage to avoid psychosis. But he also holds on to that sense of point as meaning period in French, right? And it's the period at the end of the sentence that allows the sentence to have meaning, which is utterly uncertain until you reach that point of capital, and then you have this retrojection through the sentence to understand what it means. So the point of capital is always this retrojective quality that throws you backward rather than forward. I'm sort of wondering about that in relation to Mallarmé and up to the absence of punctuation throughout Coup d'etat and various other Mallarmé objects. I wonder how you might relate that to your sense of the temporality or futurity in Mallarmé, the way that it may or may not open up into a possible future rather than be entirely sort of retrojective in that way.
But it's not just a choice between future or retrojection, right? I mean, it's really the effect of sort of a retrospective illusion that suggests that order already was there in the first place. And I think this is also essential in understanding of the operation of a point de capiton, that it gives the illusion that there is an identity to the subject that precedes arriving at the period of the end of the sentence. Right? And it's that loop, I think, that makes the art world and the artwork run. Right? It's that loop of constantly positing a minimal liberation of some entity or object from its constraining set of conditions or the flow of commodities, and the minimal cut in which it is so-called subverted or defamiliarized or style or inscription of a name or even a trademark takes it momentarily out of this, as though this is then expressive of the unity of even, you know, individual artistic genius or the genius of a new artistic movement or school or the curator today.
So then is the way out of the loop? I mean, is that how you understand the sort of self-reflexive reference to capitalage?
I don't see a way out of the loop. That's the pessimistic solution, or the pessimistic answer. I don't see a way out of this loop, because in other words, you would have to postulate again and rely on some kind of notion of interventionism that would break out of it, and then you fall back into these same old traps, right, of transgression, subversion of the status quo. But I'm interested in the functioning of the loop in different genres or in different media, for example, in literature or in art. One way in which I'm particularly interested in it is that literature seems less tied to the blatant economical framing of much of what goes in the art world. Not to say that, you know, major literary prices could not have a huge effect. That by and large, the sums associated in a vulgar manner, right? The sums associated with literature are not as skyrocketing as those of Guitka himself, who's now, you know, the best-selling Latin American artist. I mean, the difficulty, to some extent, is methodological and very pragmatic, which is that, and I've discussed this with friends, like, do I want to make this argument which seems to be a rather unkind attack on Rancière by insisting constantly on this side and that side, of course, being ignored in theories of the aesthetic that are produced on this side of the line. Because to some extent, the argument of the emancipatory potential, as I think was could have been seen in the excerpts from Alejo Carpentier, does work the other way around. Right? If I understood you correctly, in the sense that, and Schmidt does allude to this, it is in fact by drawing this line that Europe also creates the conditions for the overturning of the colonial regime, right? Because it in a sense, slashes back into the face of Western European civilization. Just as the confusion of art and non-art in Alejo Carpentier's case also erases the difference between the King of France or the Black Jacobin or the high and low with clear, direct sort of political equalizing and emancipatory potential. So yes, it is precisely the aesthetic revolution that draws those boundaries, but that act of drawing is completely absent from Rancière's account. So, but then you get into a predicament, because by pointing this out, you haven't changed the framework at all. In fact, you still remain outside of it. And this is what I would call, you know, the burden of particularism, which is that in order to criticize a false universalism, it is always the particular cultures that have to mark their particularism. So any disavowed particularism that dresses itself in the garb of universalism will be unbothered by the recollection of more empirical materials that seem to contradict their sophisticated, you know, theoretical or meta-theoretical arguments. And this goes along the lines of what you point out in, you know, your texts on Humanitas and Anthropos. You can bring in all the evidence about Anthropos, and Humanitas doesn't seem to care that much about this, right? Because you have not really crossed this boundary. Because it seems that the crossing of that boundary, of that line, can only operate by activating the same mechanisms or the same thought patterns that humanitas or Western European civilization has already developed from the get-go. So this is sort of the dead-end street of the predicament that I found myself in when I started studying Latin American decadence, and you constantly have to mark or remark the particularism of that account. And I was just astonished by the absolute silence of the non-European context in even the best studies of European fin de siècle decadence or aestheticism. Just astonished. Even Rancière's reading, which is otherwise very persuasive, of this chapter in Balzac's novel, The Wild Ass of Skin, La Peau de Chagrin, if you read the actual chapter, then you see that the paraphrase that Rancière offers is extraordinarily selective. Because Rancière makes this into kind of a superposition of all times and all civilizations into a world of entities that no longer really sharply distinguish any hierarchy of styles or artifacts, right? Particularly along the lines of the noble versus the low, or art and non-art. But for Balzac himself, the visit to this Bazaar de Curiosité was not just a palimpsestic superposition of times and civilizations, but also an overview of all colonial efforts from Alexander the Great to Pizarro to the United States or English and British in Northern America that allow precisely for this creation of a proto-museum of fine arts that seems to draw no distinction from the ethnographic museum or the natural history museum. So I think this for me is the real challenge. How to address this without seeming knee-jerky, anti-Eurocentric. Right? And some friends of mine said, don't do this. Right? Like, don't make this argument, because you are pushing yourself in that position of sort of the post-colonial resentment.